Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, this is Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today, I'm very lucky to have as my guest Annie Prue, whose new book of short stories, Fine, Just the Way It Is, has recently been published by Scribner. It is the third volume in a series of Wyoming stories that began with Close Range. The second volume was Bad Dirt, and this is Fine, Just the Way It Is. And I'm curious, where does that title come from?
Mostly it's because when you make a protest about the way things are done in Wyoming, and people will often shrug and say, well, it's fine just the way it is. It works okay, and don't bother with it. Don't touch it. Leave it alone. It's fine. And it's just common talk, so it seemed like the right title for this last in the series of Wyoming stories.
Now, Annie Prue is, of course, the author, among other things, of The Shipping News, Postcards, Accordion Crimes. Her story, Brokeback Mountain, is one of my favorite stories in the world, and it shook up the New Yorker when it appeared, people shaking their heads to be sure if they'd just registered what they'd just read. And these books, I like to say that they're not like conventional collections of short stories. I don't know what word to give them, but I remember there was once something called a whiz-bang, Captain Billy's whiz-bang, and it was a collection of, stories, true life dramas,
jokes, cartoons.
Yeah. And that's the way I think of these collections, that they're meant to be as various as possible. There are stories that are written as kind of wild improvisatory jokes. Am I?
Yes, no, you're quite right. And it's fine that it's just that way, too, because the foolishness, the fun, the smack in the nose is sometimes a good thing to have in a collection, a short piece that just kicks you in the ankles and makes you laugh a little bit and lets you read something different. So, yes, I personally, that's my agent that persuaded me to do it that way, because I personally would only have had very serious stories and none of the silly stuff. And my agent said to me, Liz Darnsoff, that she really liked the shorter nonsense, fantastic stuff scattered through. So fine with me.
Well, for me, it has a real effect that you never know as you move from story to story what it is exactly you're about to receive. And so, like the surprise of the two ranch hands who discover a passion for one another in the pages of The New Yorker, the books create contexts that you don't expect. And you'll begin a story wondering, well, is this going to be a scattershot story? Or are we going to penetrate deeply into the lives now? Is this story going to be romantic? And is the romance going to hold? You don't know. And I think that one of the great virtues of the writing in your novels is not knowing, that sometimes the writing is passionate about people who can't express themselves, and the writing does it for them. And sometimes the writing is distant about people who are too passionate, and the writing gives us a perspective. And so that mixture of tones and modes, the unpredictability is here in these storybooks.
I think that's called style, maybe. I don't know. It just happens. It isn't planned on my part. I don't have a diagram, and I don't consciously think about it. It's just the way it lands on the page. What I do have is that thing that Hemingway kept babbling about in his earlier days and later lost himself, the built-in detector. And I can tell when something's really bad and really out of place and really awkward and really stupid, and fortunately have an eraser.
Uh-huh. But it's also, you know, the prose sometimes sandblasts the characters. These are people who would have perhaps taken themselves very seriously and do. They say what they would say, but the prose is arranged so that we hear their presumption and foolishness. For instance, a woman who is very aware of bringing her husband to higher political prominence.
Mm-hmm. But this stuff happens in real life, and it's fun to play with, and it's a wonderful way to move all of the characters along at once, not just one, but the call and response situation that is built into everything. To me, this works very well. That particular woman's slyness, her dreams for position, her husband's dreams, really, her triumph, her aggressiveness, her knowledge of the people around her is fun to play with. A very minor character, but she had the possibility of being a rich character. Small, but you want to make even the small parts as interesting and as solid as possible.
She's in a story called Them Old Cowboy Songs, and it's hardly, for the most part, a comical story. In fact, we return to her when we least expect her, almost like the gravedigger scene in Hamlet. Mm-hmm. Just when things are at their worst, there she is trying to protect herself against her husband's allegations that she has had a tempestuous affair. And how could she? After all, he rescued her from that cat house years ago.
Right.
I'm wondering about managing really abrupt shifts in tone when the reader is surely both astonished and in tears by what's happened to characters that we've been led to love, to go to the next paragraph and find the antics going on.
I think that making it work depends on the supporting sentences, the prose that's around that shift, because it would be very easy to mess the whole story up. But if the prose, the actual sentences can bathe the shift of tone or the scene in a kind of logical support, it works. And it works because it has to work, really.
But the surprise and terror comes in the story changing its perspective. We go into the sky. We see birds there almost as blue as the sky, beautifully done. And we realize that the prose technique has already been alerting us that the sky is larger than these characters, and it's going to bring them their fate.
That's the key word, fate and place. those two things, the fate is in the place. What happens to the characters must happen to them. It's written on their foreheads. It's stamped in the lineaments of their face. It's on the lines in their palms. That's how it has to be for them because of the place, because of the isolation, if it is isolation, because of the circumstances of where they are and when they are. So for me, that's the proper approach to a story. One of the things I liked about that story, in the few magazines in North America who still publish short stories, almost all of them are set in contemporary period. I was very surprised that the New Yorker wanted to publish a story that was set in the 1870s. And I was very pleased. I was delighted. And I think readers liked it, too. So the ability to move out of historical periods and to have the reader be pleased with that time travel is very gratifying.
Also, the story is in a way built around period details. It's structured, being called them old cowboy songs. The names of songs that were actually sung, some of them raucous, some of them, you know, heartbreakingly sad.
Mm-hmm.
And that sense that the voice can open up and give vent to shifts of sudden emotion, that these songs, when placed together, are part of the world of complete emotional shift.
Right. And you know, today almost no readers will know those songs. In another time, and I guess only folklorists and folk song scholars will be familiar with them, but I've always loved the names and the contents of those old songs as well as the tunes, so that was one of the key ingredients in shaping the story. That and a curious incident. I listened to a lot of different music, and there was a period within the last few years while I was working on these stories when I listened to the Gourds quite a lot. And there's one of the young men with that group that has a wonderful, hard, throwaway, laconic kind of voice. And I just saw the character of Archie when I heard his voice. So I borrowed the sound of his voice to give to Archie, who didn't exist until I heard the voice. So stories come from odd places, from old whiskey bottles and cowboy song names and a contemporary voice and so forth, and you put them together. That's the hardest question to answer when people say, where do you get ideas for stories? Where do stories come from? How do you know what to write about? And it's an unanswerable question because the stuff can come from anywhere, and it does. And I'm always puzzled by people who have writer's block or who can't think of what to write about. It's just everywhere.
And I think, you see, that the tone, for lack of a more precise word, of Western lore affects your sense of timing and comedy. Because, for instance, when you think of a song that you think of as sad, like, "Oh, my darling Clementine," mm-hmm. "She is lost and gone forever," and "Her shoes were number 9,
Yes, okay, that's perfect. Yes, this was a favorite song of mine when I was 8 or 9 years old. But there it is, you know, it's sad and it's funny and it's ridiculous and it's even a little bit brutal, but it's all there. And that song is a lot like the stories I write. That was a good thought.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm talking with my guest, Annie Prue, about her newest collection of stories, Wyoming Stories, Fine, Just the Way It Is, published by Scribner's. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm here with Annie Prue talking about the story collection, Fine, Just the Way It Is. To what extent is the collection woven together?
Except for the Devil in the Swamp story, the stories were all written one after another in a period of about 3 months. So they went fairly rapidly, fairly intensely, and I think there is an overlap from one to another. In a sense, it was all one story, one long story that was separated by characters and moods. But they were cohesive to me when writing them, and whether or not they're cohesive to readers, I'm not sure. I think it depends on the reader. Very much. But to me, it fit, it worked, and it was a good place to stop writing Wyoming stories.
A good place in what way?
I don't know. I just felt that that I'd finished them with this third collection. And most of the stories are about women, whereas the other two collections are mostly about men, because in that place, it's a man's world, it's man's work that runs things. And I just felt that was it, enough. So it worked for me. The three pieces together make a picture of, 150 years of time, roughly. And with some very rural characters. There are almost no lawyers or doctors or politicians in these stories. It's almost always people working on ranches or around ranches or with livestock or in the wilderness or moving through. And for me, that was fine. It was a segment of population I wanted to look at, because rural places and rural characters are given really short shrift in our culture and society. They don't seem to exist anywhere. So so I was much taken with writing about them and was learning as I went along. I used to think when I first started writing the Wyoming Stories series that there were a lot of problems with Wyoming, that Wyoming was purposely mired in the 19th century, that it was stubbornly clinging to the past and so forth. But now I think it's fine just the way it is. Uh-huh. It is what it is, and makes no bones about it. It's not pretentious place. It's gritty and down to earth, and some things happen that would be considered frightful in other places, but you get over it and you keep going and you stick it out when things are tough. So it worked, and the stories for me just came to an end.
Now, the final story is the most contemporary of the stories in this book. Mm-hmm. What's it called?
It's called Tits Up in a Ditch, and it's a particular phrase used by ranch people in Wyoming, and it means abandoned ship, all hope is gone. It means an irremediable situation. There will be no survivors. It's not used lightly, and it stems from if you can imagine a cow slipping down a bank and landing in a ditch with her tits up, her feet up, unable to get up like a beetle on its back, and if not rescued by a passerby, will die there. And in this story, the main character goes through a rather lonely childhood and ends up in that position herself, even though she doesn't realize it. She thinks it's her damaged husband. The key to the whole story is the fact that in the West, women are expected to take care of the members of the family when they're sick or ailing, that the responsibility is theirs. She's married this man in high school. They've been married. They start to get a divorce. It never quite comes through. Everything gets into a tangle of red tape and miscommunication. They come together at a point in the story where the husband is severely damaged, cannot speak. She, too, has been wounded. She considers him to be tits up in a ditch. She goes back home and has lost her own child that she had by this man through an accident of her grandfather's carelessness. And in the very end of the story, she is telling the parents of the husband, her husband, whom she hasn't thought of as her husband for some time, that he is tits up in a ditch. She's done for. It's a mess. The parents don't know. And at the same time, she realizes that because she is still married to him, she's the one in the ditch.
And the story has her returning home from the war in Iraq. They both have, unbeknownst to one another, served terms there. Mm. And again, find themselves in the same hospital, recovering. And the story is yet another story in the book, which is about fate. Mm. And about how these people, almost in a trance, have done the same things over and over and over again for three generations.
Mm-hmm.
Mother, daughter, grandparents taking care mm-hmm. of children coming their way. An astonishing sense, then, of destiny with the fatedness of the family. We come to see the function of the war in Iraq in the story as part of American destiny, in a way, that wars have their destined role in the lives of these people, and that by the time we come to this story at the end of the book, with the collection's view of destiny as a whole, it does have a, dare I say, despairing view of the function of war in American life.
It certainly can. One way to read it is to take it as a bit of a parable that says we're all tits up in the ditch. That is one way to read it that goes beyond the story or under the story. It wasn't overt, but it can be there. And again, I depend so much on a reader for interpretation of things rather than bopping people over the head. It's nice to give layers of possibility and let it work. Somebody, I can't remember who, I know you'll know, has said that the same book and the same story is never read twice. It's always a different story with every reader, which I very strongly believe. I think it's reviewers and critics who fasten a story into a mold. I like that stories should be slightly unformed, slightly open to question, to different interpretations, that they not be parsed and diagrammed and laid out this, this, and this. Better for them to be left alone so that people can think about them and get the meaning they want from them. I think that's healthy and good.
Yes, and I think that from the beginning, Annie Proulx has been concerned to keep herself out of the novels and stories, that the author's place and point of view toward them should be ambiguous and unformed in a way as well.
That's so. I like that sitting at the edge of the mesa looking around point of view. I can't write stories in the first person. I've tried it, and I just can't make it work. And I know that many, many writers find this the way to write, the most comfortable way, and they step right into a character's skin and become the character while they're writing. And I can't do it. I find it intensely uncomfortable, just constricting and frightening. So I need the space. Another reason I like Wyoming for the space. But it's I just have to have that distance between me and those characters.
I've been speaking with Annie Proulx, whose collection of Wyoming stories, the third such collection, Fine Just the Way It Is, has recently been published by Scribner. Annie, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
It's always a pleasure to see you. I very much enjoy talking to you.
It's always fun for me.
My associate producer is Alan Howard. The co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Our engineer in Los Angeles is Mario Diaz. We're recording here today at the studios of KSFR in Santa Fe, and we have an engineer, Laurel Reynolds, and a thank you to Sean Conlon. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.